I think it's more pragmatic than anything else. The Senate has already weighed in on this, and we're willing to pass this particular version of the plan.
Governor Bill Walker's new budget proposal relies on cuts and the permanent fund. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 15th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a former Anchorage man is indicted for a $1 billion Iranian money laundering scheme.
A Bentley vehicle, a Porsche, and other significant money transfers, including $800,000 of the $10 million that came to Alaska, was wired back to Mr. Zong in South Korea.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Governor Bill Walker proposed a budget that again seeks to draw nearly $2 billion from permanent fund earnings and cap permanent fund dividends. But Walker left a nearly $900 million budget gap, saying he wants to work with lawmakers to close it. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports the proposal also cuts the number of state workers by 400.
Walker's proposed spending plan totals $10 billion for the coming year. But much of that is federal funding. It includes $4.3 billion for the part of the budget directly controlled by the legislature. The amount of money raised through taxes and fees is projected to increase by roughly $180 million. But that still leaves a large gap that Walker would like to close. State Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck says Walker decided to leave a nearly $900 million gap between state spending and the taxes and fees it collects because he wants to work with the legislature.
I think it really is a recognition of that. The administration and the legislature are in this together. Last year, we proposed a slate of bills that would get us to the finish line. Some were received more openly than others. And so what we felt like this year is that we would go in with a little bit more of an open-ended plan.
Walker wants to close most of the budget gap with legislation that would draw nearly $2 billion from permanent fund earnings and keep dividends at $1,000 per person. That's about the same level residents received this year after Walker vetoed half of dividend funding. Walker is proposing the same permanent fund bill the Senate passed in the summer, but the House didn't act on. Hoffbeck says the approach may save time and effort.
I think it's more pragmatic than anything else. The Senate has already weighed in on this, and we're willing to pass this particular version of the plan. So rather than trying to start all over again, we've already got half the battle won.
The incoming House Majority Caucus will be different than this year. This year, the majority was led by Republicans. In the coming year, it will be predominantly Democratic. The proposed budget includes a $123 million cut in spending by state agencies. The cuts are offset by higher payments on state debt, oil and gas tax credits, and capital projects, leaving the total budget reduction at $28 million. State Budget Director Pat Pitney says preparing the budget was difficult.
We're trying to find savings out of a very small segment when you have the statutory required programs, whether it be oil and gas tax credits, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's the base student allocation, all of these are set by statute.
Further budget changes could include introducing a personal income tax and or a sales tax or another tax on consumption. Pitney says the legislative changes made this year could phase in new money over a year or two. Walker is focused on adding a personal income tax, but Hoffbeck says some legislators are working on a statewide consumption tax. He says this could include a value-added tax, in which taxes are applied at each stage of production of a good or service, or it could be a gross receipts tax, which would be applied to a business's total sales. The budget includes the minimum amount of oil and gas tax credits under state law. That means nearly $1 billion in credits that energy companies are due wouldn't be paid out in the coming year. Pitney says Walker would support making those payments if the legislature made further changes to the oil and gas tax system that Walker proposed last year. There was one tax increase Walker's plan did spell out, increasing the motor fuel tax from the current level of 8 cents per gallon to 16 cents in July, and adding another 8 cents the following year. Hoffbeck says it's a prudent approach.
Would ultimately top out at 24 cents a gallon, which is about the national average motor fuel tax.
Walker's proposal received a mixed response. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says she's disappointed the administration didn't take their job more seriously and identify areas that should be cut, trimmed, or eliminated. Democratic House Speaker Bryce Edgman says there is no question Walker is willing to address the state's fiscal challenge head-on, and he said the new House Majority Coalition would give his proposals a fair hearing. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Citing the state's multi-billion-dollar financial crisis, Governor Walker announced today the state is no longer backing construction of the Juneau Access Improvements Project. The road extension has been a perennially divisive issue for Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
For years, state transportation officials backed an extension of the road along Lynn Canal about 50 miles north. It would end at the Katsuhine River. The plan called for a new ferry terminal there, which would provide short ferry rides to Haines, Skagway, and the road system. Walker's office says Thursday's decision does not preclude other transportation improvements in the Northern Lynn Canal corridor. In a written statement, Walker acknowledged that many will be disappointed by the difficult decision. He says he understands the importance of construction projects, but that resolving the state's multi-billion-dollar fiscal crisis must be the priority. He made a promise, too. He says, quote, "Above all, I was reminded that Southeast Alaska communities are deeply interconnected, with or without roads, and I pledge to do what I can to support and strengthen those critical economic and social ties," end quote. Juneau Senator Dennis Egan is among the disappointed. The Democrat is especially concerned about the money already committed to the project.
So we have, you know, almost $40 million sitting here, and although the governor said that, you know, he'd work on keeping it here in the district, I'm worried about that. You know how the legislature works. But if we can use that money, there are 59 other legislators besides me that are going to try to get a piece of the pie.
Walker committed to work with Juneau and the surrounding communities to put the money to its best use. Egan says the legislature could theoretically override the governor's decision, though that's unrealistic, and the governor's decision effectively kills the project for the next budget year. Emily Ferry is with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, which has fought versions of the project for decades.
It's just good news for everyone to put it to a rest. I feel a little bit like the issue has held the region hostage in a way, particularly in terms of developing a marine highway system that is really functional and reliable. It's such an enormous sum of money that would be consumed by this project and such a kind of huge variable as to whether it's going to go forward or not.
State officials estimated the project would cost $574 million. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, a longtime Southeast resident, says it's the right decision. Juneau Mayor Ken Kelch says the decision hurts the construction, fishing, tourism, and mining industries.
Today's announcement definitely feels like a body blow. There's one thing all that Juneau agrees on. We need to make Juneau more accessible to the rest of Alaskans and a place where our working families can afford to live.
The governor's office says it's working with federal highway officials and does not expect it will need to repay federal funds. Work done to date will remain available for future use. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, should the public be given more input on fracking for oil and gas in the last frontier?
I think it's just basic good governance for Alaskans to have the ability to look at a permit, to read it, to try to understand it, and to submit a comment.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
An indictment in a bizarre international money laundering scheme was released from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage today. $1 billion that was being held in Seoul, South Korea, was spirited out of the country through a scheme perpetrated by a former Anchorage man. Assistant U.S. Attorney Steve Strachey prosecuted the case. He says former Anchorage resident Kenneth Zong created a scheme to assist several Iranian nationals and banks from Iran into subverting Korean government restrictions on the use of Iranian funds.
And by creating this false scheme, the Iranian co-conspirators of his directed him to send Iranian-held funds that should have stayed in Korea by Korean law out to the various parts of the world to approximately in the amount of $1 billion.
Who was the money going to? What was the purpose of these transfers?
The indictment doesn't list who the money was going to, but the indictment does list approximately 10 foreign countries ranging from Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, Canada, Switzerland, Austria, and Germany. And those countries and others, including the United States, is where that $1 billion was transferred out of Korea to those countries and individuals in those countries.
How did the scheme work?
As listed in the indictment, Mr. Zong and his Iranian conspirators developed a false, essentially a false business, where they would falsely order marble from the Middle East and have it shipped through one of Mr. Zong's companies to Iran. They would falsify virtually all of the paperwork in connection with this false purchase and transport, submit it to Korean authorities as being legitimate, and once the Korean authorities reviewed it, not knowing it was not legitimate, they would issue payment to Mr. Zong, who then obtained that the payment in Iranian money and then directed that money outside of that controlled environment to the worldwide financial market.
How was Mr. Zong discovered?
Mr. Zong's activities were discovered by the Korean authorities, and they were subsequently made available to us after that discovery.
Is it known how much he made, or members of his organization or his family?
The indictment charges that Mr. Zong received anywhere from $10 million to $17 million U.S. as commission or fees for orchestrating and being the center of this fraud.
You mentioned earlier, Mr. Strachey, that $1 billion had been laundered. Has that money been recovered?
It has not.
How about the money that was paid to Mr. Zong, the between $10 and $17 million? Has that been recovered?
As charged in the indictment, again, the money that made it into Anchorage was approximately close to $10 million. And that was spent on some personal residences, private property, vehicles, other investments. And the majority of those properties and funds have been seized by the government and were forfeited by the government last spring. And so a substantial amount of that has been recovered.
Is it known what the $1 billion was to be used for?
We don't have any idea as to what that money went to.
Will there be more charges against him or others?
That's not something I can comment on, but the investigation is ongoing and has been for several years, and we've not yet completed it.
There's, of course, so much concern about information on the internet and what's real and what isn't. We've seen a lot of concern around that, especially recently. What's learned after a case like this? Does it at all help to strengthen financial controls, or what kind of things are sort of learned and applied after you successfully prosecute a case such as this one?
Well, as the indictment states, this case was primarily out of Seoul, South Korea. Once the Korean authorities became aware of the nature of the fraud, they implemented stricter controls with respect to their trade agreement with Iran and how money is transferred back and forth between the two countries, because they do have their own individualized, sovereign trade agreements. So once they became aware of it, they strengthened their rules. Our rules under the charges that Mr. Zong is facing under what we call IEPA remain the same. They're very strict, and without getting approval from what we call OFAC, or the Office of Foreign Asset Control, American citizens cannot, for the most part, do any kind of business whatsoever with the government of Iran.
Is it known how the money was spent in Alaska?
The indictment charges that Mr. Zong and an unindicted co-conspirator, who's not listed at this time, conspired to spend the money in Alaska in various different ways, with the purchase of homes, condominium complexes, a Bentley vehicle, a Porsche, and other significant money transfers, including that $800,000 of the $10 million that came to Alaska was wired back to Mr. Zong in South Korea.
Steve Strachey is the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted Kenneth Zong. Strachey says Alaska properties purchased with the illegal funds were seized in April of 2014. A Hillary Clinton supporter from Anchorage is suing Alaska's three members of the Electoral College, claiming their anticipated votes for President-elect Donald Trump will violate her constitutional rights. Janice Park's lawsuit was heard today in federal court in Anchorage. It claims that since Clinton is winning the overall nationwide popular vote, Alaskan electoral votes for Trump would deprive her of her Fifth Amendment rights of equal protection and the principle of one person, one vote. The popular vote doesn't decide the winner of the presidential race, and Trump defeated Clinton by nearly 47,000 votes in Alaska. The Alaska Department of Law is defending the three electors. It's been a little over a week since an article posted to Facebook by Anchorage Assemblymember Amy Demboski spilled into a controversy during a meeting. Demboski also hosts a conservative talk radio show, and both over air and in a written op-ed, she's denied she owes an apology to an Alaska resident implicated as being part of a militant Islamic group in material she's publicly shared. Now, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, she's receiving violent sexist threats.
Demboski is no stranger to controversy, but even she's been alarmed by the surge of messages directed at her.
Over the last week, the level of vitriol has absolutely intensified.
Demboski says dealing with criticism and negative attention is part of holding public office, but this has gone beyond that. She tried poking fun on a recent show, having her producer read aloud some of the nastier remarks posted to Facebook.
It's time for Fan Mail Friday here on the Amy Demboski Show. Dearest Amy, you are a pathetic racist. Take out your gun and put it in your mouth and blow your worthless brains out.
Demboski shared screen grabs and texts of more explicit messages, some of which are overtly misogynistic. She says most are from men. Since November, Demboski has filed two police reports about harassing behavior and perceived threats to her safety, both of them prior to last week's controversy. According to the Anchorage Police Department, because the messages lack specific threats, they'll remain on file without any further action taken. Altogether, Demboski says she's modified her behavior and altered some security measures, but isn't letting the threatening messages take over her life.
I take them very seriously, especially when people are saying that I should blow my brains out. And they're saying they're going to come to my house and burn flags. You know, I take them seriously.
Other members of the assembly and senior officials at the mayor's office say that while they've gotten comments in the past, they've never received serious threats. Demboski says that when conservative callers or commentators begin crossing lines, she urges restraint and would like to see folks on the other side of the political spectrum do the same thing.
Whether you're a Republican, whether you're a Democrat, or anywhere in between, when you can police people that think like you, you know, maybe support your positions, when you can help police your own, I think it's more effective.
Demboski says she believes the national political climate is playing a role in local events, with some messages referencing her support for President-elect Donald Trump. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
the state agency that oversees oil and gas drilling held a hearing today on whether more public input is needed when a company wants to start hydraulic fracturing in Alaska. Environmental groups say this would allow more transparency, while the industry argues there are already enough rules to make sure hydraulic fracturing is safe. It's up to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to decide who is right. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Reports.
Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is so controversial, there's even disagreement over how it should be spelled.
Thanks to the applicant, and thanks to you for not spelling frack with a K.
That's John Hendricks, oil and gas advisor to Governor Bill Walker, testifying at today's Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission hearing. The hearing was about whether the public should get a chance to comment when a company wants to use hydraulic fracturing to extract oil and gas from a well in Alaska. Hydraulic fracturing is when companies pump a high-pressure mix of water, sand, and chemicals deep underground to more easily recover oil and gas. The hearing Thursday showed the debate is just as contentious in Alaska as it is in the rest of the U.S. Bob Shavelson leads Cook Inlet Keeper, the organization asking the commission to allow public comment when a company wants to frack a well. After the hearing, Shavelson said it's all about transparency.
I think it's just basic good governance for Alaskans to have the ability to look at a permit, to read it, to try to understand it, and to submit a comment. I don't see the big cost or burden or delay that comes with that.
Josh Kindred, Environmental Counsel for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, disagrees. He says the proposed change
is really just delaying for the sake of delaying, and it's being used to frustrate oil and gas development in Alaska. And those protections of the public are already there in the regulations that are currently in place.
The oil and gas industry says the commission already enacted stricter hydraulic fracturing regulations in 2014. Bluecrest Energy is pursuing a fracking operation in Cook Inlet off the southern Kenai Peninsula, and their operations could be affected by the change. John Martinick of Bluecrest agreed with Kindred in his testimony to the commission.
Hydraulic fracturing is highly regulated by stringent regulations developed by AOGCC, and I might add they're some of the most stringent regulations in the United States.
Kenai Peninsula residents testified at the hearing. Many were worried about how Bluecrest's activity will affect the environment around their community. Nanilchek resident Mike Schuster called into the hearing. He supports more public comment when a company like Bluecrest asks the commission to use hydraulic fracturing.
It does provide the opportunity for the public to be reassured that our commissions that are reviewing permit applications are hearing us and giving us the opportunity to interact and affect interpretation of the policy that supports our interests.
The commission is expected to decide on the proposed change by late January. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The Kenaitse Indian Tribe is wrapping up its first year of its new Senior Companion Program. The program pairs volunteers with fellow seniors who live on the central Kenai Peninsula. Volunteers provide help with day-to-day tasks like grocery shopping and budgeting. But those involved in the program say the companionship is just as important. KBBI's Shayla Farzan has the story.
Sticking to a grocery budget can be tough, but not for Rose Gilbo. She has a system.
First, I have to write a list down what we need at home. Eggs, milk, juice, salami.
Then she adds up the prices on a calculator, being careful to stay under budget.
I was just 1 or 2 penny close, and I did good.
Gilbo is part of the Kenaitse Indian Tribe's Senior Companion Program. The program pairs volunteers with seniors who have physical, social, or cognitive disabilities. Volunteers provide help with day-to-day tasks, allowing seniors to continue living independently. Laura Hobson, who's Athabascan, works with Gilbo as her senior companion. She's the one who taught her how to budget.
I was so proud of her. She got it all right, right down to the penny.
Hobson received 40 hours of training before she was able to work as a Kenaitse senior companion. As part of the training, she learned about a range of topics related to senior care, from fall prevention to effective communication. The program is funded through a 3-year grant from the Corporation for National and Community Service. Heather Daniels is the program coordinator. She says one of their goals is connecting the elderly with important resources.
One of our biggest challenges in Alaska is transportation, and of course our geography can isolate us because Alaska is such a wide expanse And so that can isolate our elders from getting those community resources.
But providing transportation is just one piece of the program. Daniel says building relationships is just as important.
They're gaining a friend. They're gaining the companionship that they may or may not have in their lives. They may or may not have direct family. So that companionship through the volunteer is so valuable.
Nancy Nelson is another recipient in the Senior Companion Program. Nelson, who's Chupik, lives in Soldotna. Once a week, she spends a few hours shopping with Hobson. The two didn't know each other before joining the program, and Nelson says she was a little nervous.
The first day was kind of awkward, but by the end of the time, I was kind of hopeful. And then the second time we got together, I felt a whole lot more comfortable after that.
On a blustery December afternoon, Nelson and Hobson head to a local junk shop in Kenai. They carefully comb through room after room, hunting for deals.
What kind of fur is this? Look at this.
Huh? This looks like Wolverine.
Look at the price.
Really? So cheap.
Hobson, who collects pigs, spies something special on a high shelf.
Look at here. The cookie jar.
This?
Yeah.
It's a cookie jar shaped like a pig in a chef's uniform. But Nelson isn't so sure about the quality. She taps her nail on the ceramic.
I wonder how fragile it is.
After some debate, they decide the cookie jar would make a good addition to Hobson's pig collection. Nelson buys a pack of playing cards for a dollar. She doesn't usually buy much on these outings, but spending time with Hobson is one of the highlights of her week.
It brightens my week up and it relaxes me. It helps me to forget about the stress that I had survived during that week, and it does a whole lot better than any kind of artificial medication would do.
The Kenaitse Senior Companion Program is open to anyone over age 55, not just Alaska Natives. They currently have just a handful of participants, but they're hoping to grow next year. In Kenai, I'm Shayla Farzon.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes, Annie Fite, and Elizabeth Harball in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Shayla Farzon in Homer, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.